It's my pleasure to introduce to you our next speaker, and it's rare in sort of one's life to be influenced by someone twice quite as profoundly as Gordon has influenced me. And in 1978, when I was a very hyperactive high school child, and my mom was trying to control me because I was I needed a ride home from school because the bus was just unacceptable for me in that period of time. And she worked at the phone company. And the phone company, she worked the 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. shift. And I'd get off school at 3 and then hang around the phone company, that central switching office, for an hour until she took me home. So I would generally start bugging her about 3:35 about whether or not she wanted to go home. And one of the engineers took pity on me, and he said, "I've got this thing back here. Maybe it'll interest you." And he had a PDP-8E sitting in a rack with an ASR33 on top that they used to simulate phone traffic when they were installing digital switches. And he loaded up Focalite with it and gave me the Introduction to Programming book and said, "Here." So the next time I saw my mom was about 5:30. And she normally would be bugged by me, and so she would leave on time, but she just kept working, waiting for me to interrupt her, and I didn't. So she came at 5:30, and there I was, madly typing away. And I tried to find that program. I have it somewhere, but it's this incredibly long sequential program of, you know, what's your name, how old are you, you've lived this many days, this many seconds, that kind of stuff. And from that point on, I was hooked on computers, and that's grown into a passion of mine, and it's grown into a career. And I've started two companies now based on that. At that point, it would have been pretty amazing to have that kind of an impact on my life. But then the next thing that happened was I found someone who was throwing away a PDP-8. And I got it because I said, you can't throw that away. It's a vintage computer. And they said, fine. And in restoring it and bringing things old back to life again, I found a new connection with my father, who is a gunsmith. And he restores old guns that people have collected throughout the ages. And between this, my father and I suddenly developed from a relationship where we had nothing at all in common, pretty much. I mean, I was a computer nerd, and he was a photography person, to something where we both really could relate to it. So we went back and forth, and we've had a lot of fun restoring a PDP-8M, which is out on display, and another 8E that I have. So one of the things that my father did for me when we were doing this was he helped fix up the key, the online key, the power key for the 8. And I said, you know, that's really cool. Could you do one of those for me? I have a speaker that's coming that has really been influential in the PDP line, and that would be really cool. So he said, sure. So we put one together. And as a token of our appreciation for you coming out to talk to us today, Gordon, we would like to present you with a solid gold, well, not solid, 24 karat, PDP key on a ribbon, so you can wear it with pride.
Okay. Oh, great. Thank you. Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Right. And if you want, you can take it down to my 8M and prove to yourself that, in fact, it does, in fact, turn it on.
Good.
So with that, Gordon Bell.
Thank you. I was going to take a survey and look around and see sort of how much of what I'm going to say today may or may not be of maybe of interest to you, because I'm going to stop at about 1970. I'm not going to spend a lot of time before that. So the PDP-8 is very relevant. Not going to get into PDP-11 and VAX and subsequent machines, but I am going to talk really about how all of these machines were fundamentally personal computers. And then I'll say a little bit about DEC and personal computing post 80 or so, when DEC had a chance to be in personal computing, or be doing personal computers too. You know, is it possible to have just a little more light and not sort of darken? If you can still see that, okay, I'd prefer it would be nice to. This was, you know, to people who aren't in computing, this is personal computing. We go downstairs, we say, well, this is really a vintage computer. This is personal computing. This is where it all began. The two Steves, of course, invented computers. You can go back a little bit, but then there was the Altair, which my boss was his first software for personal computing, but not his first personal computer, because that was a PDP-10, and I'll talk about the PDP-10, of course, and how that was what we were trying to do there with personal computing. And then if you go, you'll see this afternoon, well, an earlier machine, which is the McCraw. I don't know if there were McCraws downstairs or not. I'm not sure I saw one. But this was the most famous thing about this, perhaps, was it was designed in France. It was designed for the colonies, the French colonies, by a Vietnamese. And probably the most famous thing about it was that Philippe Kahn wrote software for it. When we went about a decade ago, when we went to survey to find the first personal computer, this one popped out of the woodwork. And then the other thing that popped out of the woodwork was the Kenback, which was in, which we also have in the collection, but it's hard to equate that as a personal computer. This was really a 4004 built on the first micro computer. Now let's go back, way back before all of this. So that's sort of an introduction to what one might think of as sort of modern personal computers. I'm going to talk about pre-modern personal computers, because that was these were sort of beginning in 1970, and I'm not going to say anything about that. I'm going to talk about ancient history. This is the first computer. There's no doubt about that. I was privileged to kick the conference off a couple of months ago at Manchester, and this was the machine on which the first program ran. This was a thing called Baby, and it was really a prototype for the Manchester restoration, that they actually go back and build the machine. So this I wouldn't claim quite as a personal computer. I will claim that this is a personal computer, and this is probably my first machine where I did serious programming. This was a machine that probably David Rutland may talk about. This is the English Electric Deuce, which came after the National Physical Laboratory ACE, which was a machine that Turing designed. So there are a few people around who say, yeah, I can remember programming that, because I can only say, I worked on a machine on which Turing designed. So I did this for for a year as a Fulbright scholar. And it was a personal computer. You just fed your programs in by cards, card I/O. But the other thing is, there were two of these displays, one here and one off screen, and this was some of the I/O. You could set switches here to get numbers in and out on an interactive basis. This was its main memory, and also, in this case, the display. This was a 32 by 32 grid. The first program I wrote was a program to do mouse maze solving. I spent the year working on an Optimum assembly program, which was built after SOAP, which was an IBM machine. So we converted that into a easier to program machine that did Optimum layout of the 32 word delay lines, and then those worked to a backing store on an 8K on an 8K drum, 8K word drum. The other thing that I think probably the last program I wrote was an interactive program that proposed to people, and I proposed to my wife there using that sort of interactive thing. You sort of flip switches here and answered questions and stuff like that. So it was really truly it's a kind of thing that you would write as you see in your own personal computing. So to us, using these machines machines was personal computing. So I've never used anything other than personal computing. I refuse to feed deck of cards to somebody who puts them into a queue somewhere and got answers back. So I've only worked on personal computers. Now, this is sort of some of the early tree. This comes from a science museum poster, and this is sort of now. Let's come up a lot in 1951. All of the machines that I worked on sort of were influenced, and this was at the time when EDVAC had just been working, MIT Whirlwind had been working. This is a thing called the test computer, memory test computer, which was the machine that tested the core memory. And in fact, if you go down to the History Center exhibit, you will see a plane from the first core memory, and it was from this. And it's a 1,000-bit, 32-by-32-bit core plane. And the word core has still stuck, but most people in computing today don't know. When they say core memory, that means they think it's at the core of the machine, as opposed to that was how you stored data. But after that, these were MIT-based thing. Lincoln Laboratories formed, and then they built a thing called the TX0, the transistorized experimental number 0, and then TX2. And by the way, we're going to have a talk by the designer of the TX2, Wes Clark. My former boss, Ken Olson, was in charge of the circuitry for the transistorized machine. And then out of that, in 57, digital formed, using basically the technology of that to start building modules. And so this is sort of the origin of digital. Let's go back a little bit to Whirlwind and the importance of Whirlwind. Again, it was this doesn't quite look like a personal computing computer, although it was. It was I've got the numbers here. It was about 150 kilowatts of power, sort of a normal supercomputer power, or I'll say old supercomputers. The new supercomputers, by the way, are 3 megawatts. We collectively are paying about $200 million for these machines. But this is when you could really get a cheap computer. This was a couple million dollars in the early 50s. It was 16-bit word, unlike all of the other machines of the day, which were von Neumann had sort of set, hey, you got to have 40 bits because that's 10 digits, and you don't get very much if you don't have that. So this was the first small memory machine. Had an 8K drum, a 4 kilobyte memory, and then this was the CPU and memory, et cetera. But the other thing that, in fact, it was the origin of this, the small word length real-time machines. First compiler was built on that. They did ECAD. There was text editors and calculators and things like that that were first built there. This is an exhibit in the Computer Museum in Boston. Here is the 1 kilowatt or 2 kilobyte memory. There were two of these. And in the exhibit, this sort of, here's the piece of the exhibit here. I won't talk about the people, but here's the drum. This is now the interactive part. So there was a display that was put on that for doing interaction, and that was done because this was a prototype for a highly interactive time-shared machine, and then that was the beginning of the SAGE project for semi-automatic ground environment. And that which sprang out of Whirlwind, and this was for air traffic control, and people sat around and looked at things. But then there were a whole bunch of operators that were looking at and pointing to air spots on this, which were aircraft that were coming over the North Pole that would come and attack us. And this was in the thing called the Dew Line, which is in Canada. And in fact, you'll go over to the museum this afternoon, you'll see part of this SAGE, this system, which is a 32-bit word of very large machine. I don't have any more pictures of that because I wanted to really get into
into the deck influence machine. And this was the first transistorized machine. This was built at Lincoln. It was took to it was brought to MIT, and then students used that. This is probably my second machine. That is a second machine that I spent an hour more than a little bit of time with. Another, I spent a year working on that, working on speech analysis, and a thing called analysis by synthesis, and that's the still the basic technique. A paper that I still gets referenced, the 1960 paper, that basically, and that's the way speech is still done. Speech recognition, there was handwriting recognition, neural data analysis, but we had interactive editors, interactive debuggers, and just, you could watch the program in execution on the CRT. This was a 1,000 by 1,000 point plotter, so you could watch this stuff. My wife and I wrote a program to plot city maps, and so you could put you could look at land use and various characteristics, because each dot or area represented a part of an area. And a whole laboratory, some people at Harvard saw that, and a whole laboratory got started just doing land use mapping based on that. There's some of the, more of the I/O there. These were all registers that that you could set. There was a FlexoWriter output and a paper tape reader. I designed the, how I got to DEC was I designed the tape control unit for the machine in 59. I met the digital people and said, gee, that's fun. I had started down the PhD route because I didn't want to go to work. I had been a co-op student. I said, oh boy, I'm working at a very large company. I said, gee, this isn't what I wanted to be as an engineer. I think I'd better get a PhD and do something else. So I was at MIT starting down that route. I met the people at Digital, and they said, come out here and gee, you can design a computer. And I said, wow, that's for me. And so I went to Digital based on finding out that I needed these modules for that tape unit. And meanwhile, I was doing speech analysis and air and some stuff on cross correlators for radar. Okay, let's look at the sort of the timeline. This is so here's the DEC 57. PDP-1 was prototyped and working in 60. I came in 60, and the first production machines came out in 61. Another machine that was influenced, but this is Wes Clark's machines. This was the Link, and then we merged, and then the Link 8 came out of that later on. I won't say very much about that. But the PDP-1, which is an 18-bit machine, these were all, this was another 18-bit machine that I was responsible for. The PDP-5 was responsible for, and then the PDP-8, and I'll talk about that and why it was the way it was. And then here's a machine, the PDP-6, which at least from a poster standpoint should have its own line, because it was a 36-bit machine designed for time sharing. So the idea of time sharing was, hey, we want to build, from the very beginning, is we want to build the technology that allows everybody to have their own computers. Because remember, in those kind of days, these were very expensive machines. This was a $120,000 machine. This was a real breakthrough as a $27,000 machine. The 8 was $18,000, and this was about $60,000. And then the PDP-6 was about a $500,000 machine. So the idea is you take $500,000 and you divide that by 50 or by 20, and it doesn't sound so bad because you are now amortizing that over a large number of users. As distinct from the IBM approach at the time, which was to, hey, you can have thousands of users, you just send your cards, you just put your cards at a card desk, and they'll ultimately get, you know, a day later, you'll get it done. We didn't like that. None of us had ever used a machine that way. You signed up for the machine, it was your machine, and you know, if you wanted to waste it, that was your prerogative. Although the machine I was using, the TX0, first started using here for speech. Gee, you couldn't do that because there were a lot of people around you all the time. This was a big open area. In fact, the guy who used to debug my macros, you know, because I got out of programming. But anyway, I write these macros, and there was this little kid running around. His father happened to be head of a lab for nuclear science at the time, so he could, of course, do anything. I think he was 10 years old at the time. His name was Peter Deutsch. And so he ended up, I said, Peter, what's going wrong? And, you know, this sort of 10-year-old is not very patient. When a graduate student comes in, he says, well, you stupid guy, you know. he was a little more polite than that. Well, here, you didn't put your term here. You had a parenthesis wrong or something like that. In debugging the macros. But that's kind of the basis for this. Here's PDP-1. This is the first deck computer that was really designed for interactivity. And of course, you see what it is. You signed up for it. It was $120,000, I think $135,000 with a 15 with this display, 1,000 by 1,000 point plotter, it was designed for a number of different uses, but one of which was at Livermore as an offline machine. It had the ability to take in various cards and tapes and things and do IO conversion. It was used in a lot of experiments, a lot of real time experiments for building defense kinds of things. It was used by NASA in satellite work. NSA bought a large number of them. And then as a project engineer, I built a thing called a UART, Universal Asynchronous Receiver Transmitter. And we put 256 of those puppies in, and half of the PDP-1s were sold as a thing called ADX under the IBM, or under the ITT name, to do torn tapes message switching. So that basically, that's when I fell in love with serial bit streams as the way to transmit to talk to I/O devices. In fact, this thing was the worst thing about this. The one was this IBM modified typewriter made by Soroban. I mean, because it was, you know, the machine. This thing failed, which it did very often. You actually had to buy two of these because it had solenoids. And so this thing wasn't designed to be driven by a computer, and so it would crap out frequently and. And so I wanted a reliable device. So when I got the started building IBM with the first teletypes, I got, I think it was a Model 19. I didn't see any old teletypes down there. And then there was a Model 28. Well, I was debugging with the Model 19s because they were using five-hole tape. The 28 was also five-hole tape. And I got this thing, and man, I could drive that thing all day long and nothing happened. So I said, man, that's going to be the next I/O device. Never mind this pretty output you get with, you know, we'll forego upper and lower case. I'd rather have that rather than no case at all. But the other thing that was famous about this was that this is in the museum. We haven't had it running here yet, but it does run, and is the program Space War was written for that, and it was seen by Nolan Bushnell, who started building interactive things. This tape and the machine has been used to settle various lawsuits. When somebody says, "Yeah, I invented that," 20 years later, no, it turns out it was running. Something like that was running, and we had certainly editors. I think Tico was first built to run here. It was either that or the PDP-6, various interactive debuggers. So this was really an interactive machine. It was truly a personal computer that you set up and used that way. MIT was certainly, one of the machines that was used here was the TX-0. This was in a room right next to the TX-0, but the door was closed. And at least one tale is that one day they got Minsky and McCarthy up there, and they put Minsky on one and McCarthy on the other, and said, "Hey, we really got it developed a machine that has human intelligence." And we apparently got the two talking to one another. That's a story. I don't. Alan Kotok really knows the truth of that, or Steve Russell tell. But that was the story that they were talking to one another. And they said, yeah, this is pretty good, until they found out that that it was human on the other side. This is another line that was based on Wes Clark certainly was influential in the deck architectural work. He designed this link using deck system modules, and that was influenced the architecture of our own PDP-8. The other thing that was important was the introduction of the link tape, the designer of it came to digital, and it was called deck tape, and it was 256 kilobyte tape. So this was really probably the most important part of making it a personal computer, because one now had a storage media that you could walk away with. It was designed for doctors for medical signal processing. You did interactive debugging with that small CRT, and it had an enormous number of cables that one could then feed into cats and people and whatever to do signal processing on neural signal processing and other kinds of things. Here's this little keyboard, and then it's a freestanding unit. Then our version of that, in a sense, was the PDP-5, which was a precursor to the PDP-8. The PDP-5, again, was significant for a number of reasons. And how that came into being was that I had just designed the PDP-4 for process control. And DEC was wondering whether, they ought to be in process control, because one of the first things was a control of a Nabisco processing plant that we were working with Foxborough, and the board had great ponders. Gee, should we take this order or not? Because are we liable? Because it had the power to dump sort of 12 carloads of flour into the Chicago River. We went after great deliberation, we ended up taking the order, it was running, I think, about 20 years later, which is. The other thing was how this came into being. We went to several of us went to Chalk River, the nuclear reactor in the Canadians were building. Went up there, and they had a very elaborate elaborate control system. They needed a very elaborate front end to get all the parameters in from the reactor. And so, in hearing about all that front end, Ed DeCastro, who was the founder of DG, and I, and somebody else, some sales guy, went up there, and we remember it was sort of about 40 below, and we went up from Ottawa up to Chalk River. And in coming back sort of that night, I said, gee, we can't. We don't want to build all that crap. You know, a special system, you know, you can't use it for anything else. Hey, a computer can easily do all of that stuff. And let's build something that will just be good enough to handle all of that, real-time I/O, and have enough capability in it so that, in fact, if something goes wrong in the real control computer, the PDP-4 or whatever, then it will be able to sustain the state of the reactor. And so that's how the 5 came into existence. And we put a number of features in there, including a built-in A to D that sat on the accumulator so that you programmed the A to D conversion. So we were very sensitive about cost. Flip-flops were very expensive in those days. In fact, its program counter was in memory. The other thing that made this was a major breakthrough. We had a $120,000 computer, a $60,000 computer, and this guy came in now at 27, including I/O. And the thing that made that, including I/O, was in fact the ASR 33. Again, what's important here is not necessarily just, quote, the CPU. In fact, I have a funny story about that one, which was a few years ago, the museum was asked to co-exhibit with Intel or to put an exhibit together, which they did for the 25th anniversary of the Micro for Las Vegas. Did that, and so we said, well, we've got to have the floppies in there, and Intel, of course, say, you know, what did the floppy have to do with personal computing? And, you know, without floppies, you know, there would be no personal computing. Without storage, and so in this case, without a way of, first we got rid of the paper tape reader, the punch, and the typewriter. This guy, I think, was selling for $500 at the time because it was used in high volume for the telex industry. So that was such an important component for computing. And I can't tell you how mad these guys were at DEC when we came out with a DEC writer. They were really pissed because it basically shut off all the computing industry from the market because we came in with a much lower price machine and a faster machine. And by the time we came in with that which is in the sort of early 70s, then it sort of wiped this out as a computer market. This you'll see over at the museum. Here's a link. Here's the link and the link tapes and so on. And here's the classic PDP-8 with its with that. These two keys, by the way, the interesting story about that was Ken Olson actually worked on the design of that, the design of the console. He loved design, the mechanical design, and this sort of smoke glass thing. And actually, there are two of them there, and you say, well, why were there two of them? It turns out these also held the front panel on, so you needed that. That's the reason that there were two. The other thing about the 8 was that, let's go to that, it became the first OEM computer. The PDP-5 was starting to be that, but the 8 was truly that. We invented a whole new way of a whole new distribution system where basically, hey, you just bought this. This is a component. And then you integrated that with a cigarette making machine or whatever, one of the big markets was using this for physics experimental stuff. So we had a very large share of the experimental market where people could use this in a real time thing. The other thing we did was the UART. We actually programmed the UART instruction. The sampling of telegraphy data was built in as an instruction, so we could actually use this as a concentrator for a large number of teletypes. And in fact, Livermore used this as one of their front ends. But the other thing, I'd say probably three quarters of the machines were built used as componentry for integrating with other systems. The other thing that happened was OS 8 came out of that, and OS 8 was really a version of the PDP-10 time-sharing system that was built on the PDP-8. Now, Larry Ritchie did that, who's one of the Brooklyn Poly, one of the five or six Brooklyn Poly grads that probably did more creative stuff at DEC than any other five people. And then out of that begot RT11, which begot CPM as the interactive system, and a lot of these were sold as interactive personal computers. PDP-8 modules. The modules were built like this. These you may see at the museum as an exact replica of the IBM SMS modules. We copied that without shame, because a wiring machine could then wire the back panels. And the irony is that the concurrent with the PDP-5, Eddie Craster was the project engineer on the 5. I was the engineer on the 6, which was a large time sharing system. So I was had my hands full with that. The first thing we found out about the PDP-6, it had was two bays and a very dense wiring, was that we couldn't really afford to make this machine very well because we had ladies in Maynard. We'd employed all the ladies in Maynard to wire back panels. And so they were wiring these back panels, and there was a large number of errors. And so debugging consisted of finding these wiring errors. And so I said, gee, why don't we wire them right in the first place? And about the same few years earlier, IBM had worked with Gardner Denver, IBM and UNIVAC, to produce a wire wrap machine. And the wire wrap machine was critical to the minute to reducing the PDP the 5 to from 27,000 to $18,000 because we could afford to make them and build them in this form factor. These are in 65 were still not IC machines, even though the IC had just started to be reforming. Not very many pins here on that. So you'll see a machine over there by Honeywell or 3Cs, and they unfortunately had not solved the pin problem. I think there were 18 pins here. And so you would see modules like this cut off like that, and you'd see two, maybe one or two ICs mounted on a module. So basically you get the idea, gee, this is the wrong way to build a computer with when you're essentially pin limited, but it worked just fine for that. So, sort of enough of the PDP. Here's an AD, and then and here's a little bit of the tree. So the 8 was the 1, and then the 5 in sort of 64, and the 8, and then various other things that came out of that. The 338, which is one of the first, I think probably the first display processor that is a processor that had its own instruction execution. Again, interactive, for interactive work, it was sold, it was sold to Ivan Sutherland, who was then at NSA doing goodness knows what, but making a very, very elaborate interactive console. And so that came out of that. 680 was this teletype, this concentrator that it was used for. 8S, which was a dead end and not a good idea. It was a serial machine. And then here we introduced the 8I, the integrated circuit, the L and the E, and then all of these machines up here. And then ultimately, in the sort of early 70s, Intersil made a single chip 6100. My first interaction, I had been at Carnegie. I sat out this 66 to 72, which it turned out to be a wonderful time not to be at DEC because they were just redoing machines. So I went to Carnegie to teach at the time. And that was the transition from I'll say second generation to third generation, from components to ICs, and not very much started happening here. I came back at this time because we could put a processor on a chip. In fact, the first thing I did in 72 was to go out visit Bob Noyce. I think I visited Bob and Gordon and said, hey, will you please make a PDP-8? Can we give you a PDP-8? And they said, no, we got our own little path here. We're going to go build 4004s. And I think they had the 8008 on the drawing boards. I don't remember whether it was on or but ultimately, we got Intersil to build that. And this was always a problem at Digital about its paranoia of gee, do you want to give up chip rights? And I was absolutely radical. Get rid of that design. Get anybody else that we can to make it. If we can't compete with anybody who takes those chips and does something, then we're in bad shape, because somebody else is going to take chips and make the same thing. I'd say when I left in 83, we were still having that argument. I tried to get rid of the PDP-11 in the same spirit of, gee, the 11. I tried to get rid of VAX in the same thing. Let other people build those chips. Because it was very expensive to maintain that, uh, that, that design, that, those kinds of art. This is some of the, this is a price per 12-bit word, or a byte and a half, and that's, that was, oops, 30 cents. Let's see, okay, next, where did I say? Let's see. Let me, yeah, let's just go back there. Oh, let's see. Yeah, where am I? Yeah, so this was sort of 30 cents for the 8. Here's when it was sort of a dollar for a byte and a half with the 8L. 6,000 would be about 70, about that. So here's a dollar, kind of a dollar a byte in 72. Which is considerably under what everybody else was doing. The other thing is, if you look at the PDP-8 price, system prices over time versus just looking at the CPU prices, then we got down to, we eventually got under, in the 80s, got under that, but VT78 was an intercell-based thing, which had two floppies and a CRT for about 15K, which was used for word processing, and also RT11, which that's too complicated. This is a little too complicated. Let's not go over to that. So there's one theory, one thing, which is we're trying to design the lowest cost machine that we can for various OEM applications and for approaching the interactive for people who want to use them on a personal computing basis. But concurrent with this was the development of timesharing. And this was an idea that had sprung out mostly around MIT. There were a couple of memos on that by McCarthy and Minsky about building a large machine that everybody could sort of interact with, and then you took whatever that large number was and divided by the number of users, and you got lower cost per user. At this sort of the same time, the Dartmouth guys had built the Dartmouth timesharing system, from our point of view, they had cheated because they had used a single language, and to us, that was not a general purpose system. We wanted to be able to run any program that you could use as a user from a teletype or glass teletype or whatever. So this was built, introduced in 65, and it was the first computer that was used for time sharing. IBM was still fighting this thing, even though the 7090 was used at MIT and built, and they used the MIT guys had built a thing called CTSS, compatible time sharing system, or comprehensive time sharing system. I can't remember then what the C stood for. The first time sharing system, TOPS 10, or the PDP-6 time sharing system, was fundamentally used, was very much a copying of a lot of the ideas there. Yeah.
Did the PDP-6 have a front end processor like the 1140 did on the 10, or did that come with?
No. We had no front ends. It had. Had UARTs basically, and you dialed in or connected directly into it. So we wanted to sort of keep the cost low. It was about a $300,000 entry price. One had banks of the deck tapes, and in fact the entry level system didn't have a disk, but in fact, you were assigned a tape, and so you would read. Since these blocks were replaceable, you could read and wrote to those. The editor, it was also a minimal 16 kiloword system, 16 kiloword or 64 kilobytes.
time sharing. That is, we said time sharing meant, we finally defined it to be more than one user. And so we could put two users in there. The first editor was 1 kiloword or 4 kilobyte editor. It was a line editor. There was a thing called PIP, which I think the name has gone and stayed in other, has come down with other things. Peripheral interchange program, which is you can convert anything to anything else. And the idea was to make this thing I/O independent. We didn't want all these I/O calls that people were used to. So we had basically defined a virtual machine that, in fact, you were assigned various that you didn't have to bind your application to a particular device. I showed this to Gwen, and she said, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "This is the entire development team for the system." Were the main workers on the CPU, which was two bays here, and Alan did the floating point. I did the logic of everything else. This was the my secretary. We had a couple of technicians, a mechanical engineer, technical writer, Morris Harris Hyman, who wrote the assembler and then the back-end assembler for Fortran, Peter Sampson, who's in this area, wrote the Fortran compiler. He was writing the checkout, the diagnostics, and a draftsman and two or three technicians. So this was the team. And Restone circuits. So we had the whole thing. So I think the significant thing was really the size of the group that we did to do it, and that was part of the reason, a big draw of going to digital. I looked around, and gee, they didn't have. I had worked, as I say, for a large company building military equipment, and they had seas of desks of engineer and one person. Well, I'm pretty in charge of. I'm designing the flip flops. So I didn't like that. I said, gee, there's no big deal. One person should be able to design a whole computer. So that's what we set out to do, and this was the beginning of the DEX. In fact, here's the line right here, sort of in the 64 is PDP-6. The 10 came out in 67. By the way, the 6 was first used at Livermore in a dual processor. This was at the heart of Octopus, which was the switch that brought in every peripheral, data from every other machine. And kind of the reason that, among other things, they chose it was that the memory was the specs on the memory interface were there, the I/O bus was there, and so it was easy to know what it was. The other thing I claim is that we probably started the add-on memory business, the idea that there should be add-on, or that there could be add-on memories, because we sold one to Stanford, and Stanford, the first thing they did was said, gee, your memory prices are too high. They went to various places, Fabrotech and other places, and got add-on memory. So I claim that we initiate, by having good, clean specs, we basically stimulated the idea that this is modular and you could buy them from anybody. Yes?
Was this the first computer that had the asynchronous I/O bus, so that you could put just about anything?
You could, to my knowledge, that was unlike the 8 and other machines that were clocked. You brought stuff on in by the clock. No, it was an asynchronous, and to some extent, it was an asynchronous design. There were real waits out there until somebody responded, and the machine would sort of go dead and come back up on a responsive basis. It was triggered by delay lines. And in fact, there was one piece in there that was totally asynchronous. We had an asynchronous multiply. Or an asynchronous adder that, in fact, came up when all the carries had stopped. The machine started up again.
Anyway, the KA-10 was the six. We built 20 of those. Again, very hard machine to build. It was built a germanium machine. The problem is we didn't have enough heat flow through it, and also, as I said before, this stimulated the notion of we have to have a wire wrapping machine simply because of the cost and the errors. It just takes too long to debug by humans or plug in and make an automatic tester. So we said it was easier just to do it right than to test it. Generally, it's easier to do it right than to build a test jig that will test when you've done it wrong. So basically, we took the philosophy of let's do it right. Let's just get something that's going to be a perfect wire thingy and do it that way. So the K10 and then the KI10 KL, and sort of this got to be the end of the 10 line with the 10s, and this was deck system 20 here, which was really built on derived from the BBN operating system called 10X. But these initially were all evolved from the first work that we did on time sharing. And these were dual processors here, and there were dual processors there. We never got more than a couple processors in that. Let's not go into, these are PDP-11 stuff. These are another story. This is one of, people say, well, why was DEC so bad in, personal computing? And this is sort of a true statement that, in fact, really didn't see that as a, why would you ever want a computer in your home? The irony was that it was, I think, 69, I have a memo, which I still have, in 1969 outlining a research project. I was at Carnegie at the time saying, gee, we ought to take a bunch of PDP-8s with deck tape and put them in homes because there's a lot of things that you can do there. Let's start developing this because someday the price is going to be low enough, and it would be nice to be there when to have that experience when we're ready to do that. At the time, I had taken a sabbatical from DEC, 6-year sabbatical from DEC, and was teaching at Carnegie. And one of the first machine I had at home was a 2741 connected to a 360 Model 67, which could handle about 45 or 50 users. And just for the hell of it, I said, gee, here we spent $3 or $4 million on this thing. A PDP-8 will outperform it. Watch. And a graduate student, Ad Vandegor, who's now a professor in Holland, designed a time-sharing system, a drum. DEC marketed it as the PDP-8 time-sharing system, and a few hundred were sold. Guess what? It did outperform the 67 for various I/O. And so a lot of people used those as their time-shared system because it was a drum. It swapped very fast, and so we could handle fairly large number of users. So we were a couple of orders of magnitude cheaper than the 67. I've got more. I don't know what we probably. I'm out of. I mean, I've certainly outran my time. Some other time. There's another statement from Ken. Ethernet. This is. I love this one because we had a fight about Ethernet. This is a true statement. I believe that. And I wouldn't put my company on the internet. And here he is. Here's his company. So anyway, you'd better be an average user. I'm proving I'm an average user there. And the interesting thing is, did I understand our personal computing was going to go the way it did? But again, I think that's another 15 slides. And so let's not do those some other time. So anyway, I got you up to all I know about it in 70. And I won't tell you what happened after that.
Any questions?
What happened to the ladies in Maynard? They got cast out of their jobs.
Well, there were still lots of things to do, packing modules in there, and because we made the modules there too, and so there's a lot of handling and stuff like that.
The quote from Ken Olson, isn't that connected with an effort or a project by the David Hall did? Tell us anything about that, or is that for the next one?
Yeah, that's for the next one. Yeah, that was in it later on. Yeah.
Do you know what happened to the city before there was the Chicago Bakery for this one?
It was there for about 20 years. The other one was at the other one was which we were designing for at the same time was a glass Corning glass factory application. So these were real time things. The four successor, the 7, 9, 15, those things ended up as being the sort of mainstay, and until VAX, and so, you know, we had sort of brutal fights, you know, internally of ultimately later on of, gee, if we do that, it'll cut off our 18-bit business, and it'll cut off our 36-bit business, and so, which it did, yeah.
You refer to the PDP-1 as the first computer that Digital designed to be used interactively, something like that.
Yeah, it was the first computer.
Oh,
it was Deck's first computer.
That's what I was on.
Yeah, and it had the model that came out of all the experience that we had with TX0, TX2.
Oh,
all of those machines were used personally. That is, you signed up and you got the whole machine, and you were controlling it as opposed to an indirect control that you were doing at the same time with an IBM installation where you fed cards to somebody who they fed to the machine. Yeah.
So is there a PDP-1 simulator? And if not, are you going to get one?
There's a one simulator. Bob, there's a person at Digital that is really into the simulators. By the way, I had Bob Supnik, who's head of research now, and I talked to him the other night, and I have a whole bunch of 8-inch floppies that will run on WIPs, and I've found a guy that converts for them, because I've got my old memos and things that are on that. But big problem is media. I think the one to me is a machine that, you know, a significant machine that I'd like to see kept up. Because even though there were only 20 that, there were 40 machines built. 20 were sold for message switching. 20 were used in various ways, including time sharing stuff. There was one used, BBN used them for their time sharing system of a hospital. McCarthy had one, and Pat Soupy's had one that they were used for early. Computer-based training. And so there they were all used in the first experimental stuff stages for that. But the one is really a machine that I think we'd like to be able to keep enough spare parts around. We just the talk before this by Jim Whitting was, you know, sort of, yeah, that's a machine that should be kept up because of the significance in space war. I mean, if you're going to fool around with a machine, it's important to have it be an important machine, other than it happen to be the first computer you happen to be programmed. Because there are a lot of bad machines out there that were your first machine that you might want to forget about. Yeah.
Somebody's saying that the Stanford's DeepSix, after it was donated to the Boston Computer Museum, has been disassembled for souvenirs.
I don't know that whether we had some spare parts. I don't know whether it came out of that or not. Whether the 6 is not a machine that I think we can keep running again. There's a 10, there's a K, there's a KL at Moffitt. But a K would be very nice. But apparently, if I understand it right, Paul Allen has a time sharing system that he
10 time sharing system that he keeps up. That was built, I think, maybe built by Systems Concepts or...
No, by the XKL.
Okay.
Yeah, I have an account on there.
And okay.
The KL in the museum came from Timeshare, which had been renamed to McDonnell Douglas and BTMA.
Okay. Yeah, we should talk about... because, again, there's a machine that I think we'd like to keep up because of the R. Again, there a lot of people did their first programming on that. Bill Gates and Paul Allen certainly did learn to program there, and that's where they wrote their the BASIC was written there. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wondered what happened with your 69 memo suggesting.
Well, I tried to get it established as a research project, but I was at consultant at Carnegie at the time, and it really didn't get going. Probably the name Dave Wall came up earlier, and he was pushing for lower cost machines, but he was into the sort of BASIC, build BASIC at the time, and then later on the PDP-11s came in and built. And there were a lot of time sharing system. There, the RISTAs came in as a single operating or a single language system. And the thought was, well, that's as near as we're going to go at that time. But the whole deck starting into personal computing around after the we had all of these machines in there. The Altair, the Apple II, the IBM 5100, everything that came out, we had, and in fact, we had built a lot of prototypes of small machines ourselves at that. And at the time, the IBM announcement, DEC had three personal computers, a PDP-11 based one, CPM 80. I guess 8088 based, and a PDP-11, a PDP-8. So, at that time when the introduction came, we were introducing three personal computers. The thought being three is better. Don't put your eggs in one basket. Put them in three. Of course, they were all the wrong baskets.
I had the unique experience of working the bill in the early 80s, and it's kind of interesting because we found the easiest way to get stuff done was just to drop the name. And this is for the Clock Tower Project, which I believe became the Rainbow, if I'm not mistaken.
Do you work for Barry then? Or yeah.
I worked at the CAD section.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Stuff. But... I also look over the shoulder of the developers with the notes files that they're keeping on the network. It's an interesting experience, and I'm wondering if you could comment on where you thought the principal failure or the principal cause of DEC's early stumbles in that personal computer arena were caused more by just lack of engineering vision, or was it?
No, I think at the time the engineering vision was fine for that instant in time. But what happened was the massive, I'll say, galvanization around the standardization of the PC, and that I attribute to Microsoft and the availability of the chip. That there was a standard there, and that people, in fact, made it happen on that basis. So it was that all happened. And then DEC, then the response at that point, not immediately responding, in kind and saying, "Hey, the game's over." And then DEC being again proprietary, tremendous amount of back and forth. I was the radical in there on standardization. And my mantra on standardization has always been either make the standard or follow the standard. And if you fail to make the standard, then you get to do it twice. But you ultimately will have to do it again.
But But in, you know, you mentioned the other you wanted to outsource the manufacturer of the PDP-11. Doesn't that
chips?
Yeah, doesn't that kind of drive you more to like being a software producer as opposed to?
It makes you, no, not necessarily. You can be very creative in the platforms that you do. I mean, everybody else has done just very fine. I mean, there are people like Compaq that do very fine in being a manufacturer. So I never saw that way. That you could still, although it is very difficult to be both hardware and software. No, I will claim no one has yet done it successfully. In being both a hardware and a software vendor. Okay.